Right, we're back for Counterpoints, and we are going to, on this episode, the third one, obviously just had the Blast Fall Open in London, and the winners were not Vitality, which is already headline news. But I actually think what's amazing is, if the winner had been anyone else, if it had been Mouse Finally Wins, if it had been Spirit Wins another one, you know, by the way, you can see what storylines would continue. If somehow Falcons had got, I mean, they weren't there, but if they'd been able to come and win, Mongols even, another team that wasn't there. If certain teams had won, I feel like actually everyone already knows what narrative to pick up. But instead, I think because G2 of all teams won, I feel like actually a lot of fans are just sort of like, what? I can't even think on that final. I rewatched the finals before we did this, Pimp, because I wanted to see what did all the analysts do? And as far as I can tell, did you actually pick 3-0 for Vitality?
Nope.
Right, well, the others you've had them winning 3-2 though, yeah?
I had Vitality winning 3-2.
Yeah, right. First of all three analysts did pick Vitality, which is correct, by the way. At the time, no one had any reason to believe otherwise. And in fact, if people don't know, Maui and Vu both took them to go 3-0, particularly because of the maps that were picked. Like, at the time, if people don't know, we never saw Overpass from G2. That was going to be the third map. And then you saw the first two maps with Dust 2 and Mirage. Like, that probably should be Vitality 3-0 if it was Season 1. And no one really knows the new G2. So I actually feel like, in some ways, if you're one of those people out there in the scene complaining, like, ah, it's boring when the same team wins all the time, I always tell you don't really mean that. What you mean is not that you want random event teams to win every event. Like, right now, I'm actually a little bit worried. If it really is going to be a different team every event, it's probably not going to be that good. This is different though, mate, because I actually feel like G2 winning is a really good thing for CS, mate, because one thing I wanted to get into, I thought there's so many parts we could talk about, is if you look at the construction of this team, Pimp, there has been so much, think about teams like Falcons, FaZe Clan, there's so much that's been discussed over the last few years about signings and buyouts and how do you build a team and, you know, do you have to have the superstar player? I feel like if you look at a team, it's funny, it's like a lot of Source Pass teams. This guy just understands something about team building that I think most of us maybe don't, or he's got some edge on how to do it because he's done it again, Pimp. Here's what I don't get. He's never had the fucking Zebu player. Like, think about it. The joke is the actual closest he's ever come for real are people like Sphinx, Sun Pius, Nerds. Now, these are fucking good players. I'll tell you what, if you go past the Zebus, yeah, they're one layer below. But there's a difference there, mate. You can give a lot of people these players. They won't win championships. You know, they'll be like playoff team or even worse, they individually will be the HLTV top 20 player, but they'll never win the major for you or something. So I feel like this is why I actually do think the secret sauce with G2, before we get any of the players, surely has to be the coach saw. Like, this guy just has the Midas touch, Pimp. Like, I'm thinking already of some of the great football managers where they don't need to have the best player in the league. They just go to teams and gradually the pieces just come in and eventually their style of player works and they just start winning. What do you think of the saw approach? What do you think of this angle?
I think it's a good angle, and it's something we briefly discussed on the segments as well during the final. Obviously, we're very time restricted in those segments, but I think the way I phrased it was that Saw is probably the coach and the player, I guess, or the personality within Counter-Strike esports in history that has made the most or has been the most lucrative guy ever to sign for any team ever.
Yeah.
You know, you look at what he did in Ents, they sold off players, you know, very expensively when he was still. Go to Heroic, you sell Tenea for a ridiculous amount of money, you sell Sun Pius for money, you sell off, you know, an entire team, Heroic. Well, he also didn't win anything, but he showed the world that there was certain talent within the team, and now he's in G2, where it's not necessarily about him going to sell players, because I think G2 will be able to actually keep the players he has right now, but it doesn't matter where he goes, he will find your success, you know, and success is measured in different different ways. One is what he did with Ents, where they were like the second best team in the world. They won Dallas in 2014, I think. Or 23, yeah. I guess Vitality, by the way. Were the second best team, you know, got into two or three grand finals in a row at big tier one events, again, with a very limited roster with Duha, you know, with a guy that is nowhere to be found right now. Players where you think that's not going to be sustainable. Snappy, for that matter, as well. Went into Heroic, made them sell players for 5, 6, 7, 8 million, and now he's in G2, where if they wanted to sell Mattis, if they wanted to sell Heavy Guard right now, they'd be two of the most expensive players in the world. So that's one way of looking at it. You know, I think he's probably the guy that is worth the most money, or yes, whatever he's being paid in salary has tenfolded, you know, wherever he's gone.
Yes.
Now he's also able to win trophies. Now he's able to win tournaments. Now he's at a team, at an organization that actually has the financial capabilities to keep the players and support him, you know, even maybe in the future. Working with right now is deemed not good enough or is not figuring it out, then it can go out and actually buy players that would fit into his system. I think Saw is I think he has been one of the most underrated personalities winning Counter-Strike for quite some time. And the argument to him has always been, yeah, but has he won anything, you know? Or like people ask all the time, yeah, coaching Malik, he's not coaching at Falcons, he's not coaching at G2, he's not coaching Na'Vi. But now we get to see that Saw can easily take that step up, you know? And I think that's probably one of the most underrated storylines for G2 winning Blast. Obviously, the whole Heavy Garden. But Saw is the big star within that team still, to me. Yeah,
yeah. On that line, this is why I also say I think people have to rebuild team, like rethink team building. Not because it's the notion that like this guy has the formula, but I think the underrated thing, Pimp, for real is people only think of coaches as like an afterthought. It's like you think of the roster, you think of the org, like, can they get good players? Do they have good players? Then what you think is like, right, who's the coach of this team? But actually, I think people like Saw actually do suggest like these people build you the team, mate. Like you don't just bring these people in and go, right, here's the players you've got, go for it. Like this person has to be there, hopefully, from day one of making the roster. That's actually why the timing of when they brought him into G2 was also pretty good, because it was time for a rebuild. It wasn't like in past G2 lineups, you know, you take one player out each season and then it depends who you are. If you're the coach or the IDL, you just deal with those players. I mean, it'd be the people you picked. You just go what you can. This guy's shown to me, like, here's what I would say after watching this guy. First of all, I actually think he's underrated in this sense, Pimp. If you think of other people who've done similar things, made good squads with like lesser parts, I don't think any of them are as unique as him, though. Like, I'll give you the obvious parallel to me would be Cyclone from Mouse. But the difference is, those are all his boys, mate. He had those people for a year. That's the equivalent of being the guy, like, think of some of the examples like fucking Barcelona. That's like you were with the youth team and then you all got promoted together and now you coach them at the top level. Like, there's a logic as to why you'd have a special sentiment. Saw doesn't have that. He picks these people and just has to play with them immediately. The other one, the obvious one, is everyone loves Ash from Gamer Legion because he killed it with all the YouTube content. Problem there is, mate, he's never been on a G2. He's always been working at that low level where, again, it's impressive he finds these players from nowhere, but we don't expect him to have to win the championship. As you said, that was an actual knock on Saw. Some people will be like, yeah, but how many trophies has he won? It's like, that's actually a compliment, mate, that now they expect you to like win everything as well. Because I do think, like, what this shows me is this. I feel like the mistake we all have made, it's easy to do it because stats are just there on the screen and you can look at them, whereas the eye test is so much more murky, is I do feel like a lot of people think every top org pimp should almost just go, right, I need to sign some players. Pull up the HLTB top 20 for last year, and then they really think you just start at the top and work your way down until someone says yes. That approach, maybe in the old days, mate, where it was a lot about players, just players, maybe in the old days that's not a bad approach because you'd end up with, you know, your best star would be the best player you can get, and then you'd build around him. That's not a bad idea. I think in the new world that we live in now, mate, where the gear has so many more elements to it, and scouting and coaching is so much more, I feel like the change now needs to be this. You only do that, mate, as the first signing, when it's like, you can buy like Zero or Donk or Simple or some like fucking soup. If you can't get that person, mate, I would actually say my hot take would be, start with the coach. Just start with a guy like this, then build out from that. Because here's the other thing that you're going to do, I feel like it's misunderstood about people like Saw, is because they give him the say in who he gets. Like, it's not about are all these players awesome. Some of those ex-Sangal players in Hero clearly aren't that awesome. They're just all right players, mate. But they're clearly people like he knew what he was looking for, or he knew what he wanted, or he had a sense how they'd fit together. Because I actually think low-key, Benjamin, it didn't do as much competitively. Actually, the heroic lineup might have proven the most. I mean, the joke is from that one lineup, now everyone's like, Tinate is a must sign. He is a top five player in the world. Yeah. And then also, everyone's like, wow, look at these other players. No one gave a fuck about these people, whether they're in Sangal and fucking Metasport or whatever. No one cared. Mate, so I actually think low key, again, there aren't many of them on the ground, so this isn't great advice. If you're listening now and you're like, oh, I sign a Saw, it's like there's about three of them in the world, mate. But I think they're underrated in this sense, because I do think before we can get to the players in a sec, but I don't think you can overlook that. If this guy was the one who put it all together, like, I do think this team. The most obvious comparison to me is Mouse, mate. I look at it, it's like it's the blend of all the players. It's amazing. Even though Heavy God won the MVP, mate, I don't even need him to be the best every event. He could have an event off and fucking Matisse could have a carry event, or maybe, I mean, the obvious angle is like some Pius get his game together. This all, but I could see it being like a Mouse. It's not like a one-man carry job, but I do think people underestimate the coach isn't just like he's part of it. He seems like he's like the fucking mastermind of it. Do you think so? Do you have a different take?
Yeah, I buy your point with Saw. I buy the fact that I think he is one of the most underrated guys out there. And I also do think it's something we're moving into in the modern era, you know, where coaches actually get to build their team within the team and also take on more responsibility and also more of the pressure on their shoulders. It's something we see in football all the time when, you know, let's say Chelsea sacks Jose Mourinho, right? He's built up a squad, built up a team. He signed players in 6, 7, or 8 transfer windows. And now all of a sudden a new coach has to come in and it's technically not his team. It's not his players. And that makes it difficult for him to work with it. Whereas if you in Counter-Strike, we're not there in terms of the maturity level yet, where all the teams are starting with the coach. But I think we'll get to a point where they also realize that when they keep buying players or keep signing players or giving a guy like Monesi, you know, a three-year, four-year contract or whoever they may sign, then it needs to be a player that is either, you know, so good that you can use him whoever you are, or it needs to be, you know, with the vision that the coach wanted him or the coach we're getting wants to work with this guy. And I think that's where Saul have figured it out in a way. There's also the way where G2 would not have worked out, you know, where Saul would have come in, he would have pointed towards Mattis, he would have pointed towards, you know, Son Peas as well, brought him in for his work, and it didn't work out. Well, all of a sudden, internally within G2, you can also, you know, pinpoint some of the blame towards Saul and be like, we gave you all the tools you wanted, we gave you all the players you wanted, we signed all the players that you requested. Why is it not working out? Whereas I feel, at least internally, it's hard to do that when you just bring in a coach and basically he takes over a team like Tested, for example, with the old G2 lineup, where basically he took over a team where half the team didn't want to be there anymore. You know, half the players were trying to go somewhere else. It also makes the work condition for Tess extremely difficult. So I think that's just another nuance we have to consider when we judge coaches. You know, if a coach is on a team and it's not his teams, it's not his players, then I think that's a caveat, or that's at least a notion that we need to portray and need to take into account when we judge his success within the team. Whereas if it is the coach's team and if the coach has been there for a year, Blade is a great example in Na'Vi right now. He has all the players that he pointed towards. He's been working with some of them for a long, long time. Now it's not working out. They go out, they sign McCarthy. If that doesn't work out, you know, they go out, sign a new player. If that doesn't work out, it's arguably Blade's team. He's the one pointing on the players he wants to work with. And if he can't figure it out, then at some point his job is on the line. So I think there's a big difference in coaches that, at least from the outside, like you described Cyclone as well. Well, it's his players in G2, it's Source players. In Na'Vi, it's Blade players. But there's other organizations where, again, you know, a coach is coming in and it's not necessarily his team. He's just hired to be the best possible coach he can be with whatever tools he got to work with. Astralis is a great example, you know, in Rogue. It's not his team, but I'm not sure the team would be looking much different, even if it were. So I think that's an interesting conversation for the future. And I think you're right when certain organizations in the future will be more aware of that. You know, I think when they go out and invest a lot of money in players, they need to make sure that that's a player that is either so good that he can be worth it, so to speak, for all the new coaches coming in, or it has to be a player that is fitting with the profile that whatever coach you bring in with him as well. And that's something that's just going to happen, you know, as long as we keep maturing in the scene and as long as the players keep signing long-term contracts, which seems to be the deal for a lot of organizations right now.
Yeah, two things quickly. One is, I would say, I agree. That's also why, both sides, I agree, apply. Blade's a perfect example. In the same way as if you do win with the line of Blade for that major, we'll give you way more props, mate. We'll basically say you were maybe even the most important part, but I agree with you. If it goes a year later and then the team's whatever, and you also made those choices, we should also blame you more potentially, or you should actually potentially, exactly. Maybe the question should be, are you the person who gets replaced? I mean, let's face it, everyone else was fine doing that with Zonic and Falcons, but I noticed they don't always...
I think that's what's happening with Sonic right now. Now he finally, even before so, but now he finally got all the players that he wanted. Yeah. You know, there's no excuses left for him. It's his team, you know, and he has all the tools in the world to get that working. If Sonic can make the current iteration of Falcons work, there's not another two roster changes, you know, in the bank of his. Then he will have to be the next one to go, because then you will have to come to the senses that maybe it's not the players that's the problem. Maybe it's the coach that can't figure it out right. And I think that's the perfect example right now, that he's also a guy that he has... his team, it's his players, it's all the players that he requested, that he wanted to work with. Now it's your time to figure it out, you know, and let's see if Falcons can do that.
Another reason, I'll also put it out there, that I don't blame anyone for not expecting G2 to just immediately win a big event like this, is the other factor, as well as the Saw component of, like, how would he work with this team? The probably the biggest question mark of all is actually just Hunter. Remember, he wasn't an in-game leader before. People now can just look and go, it's awesome change, and, you know, there was all the rumours he should have done it all these years. Like, the problem with that is, you know, this is someone who used to play, mate. There are so many stories of people who maybe, you know, over a bite, like, oh, maybe one day I'll become the in-game leader, or the worst one, obviously everyone knows the twists in the cold zeros of the world, the one where they did it as the secondary caller or the Yekindars, and it worked awesome. I mean, my joke would even be for Yekindar, please learn the lesson that actually surely what Fury assures you is you are a good secondary caller. You're just not the fucking main IGL mate. Like, that just isn't your role, at least at this point in your career, because I feel like the problem you have with that move of like a player, notice it's always the player where they either did calls or some component. I mean, people said that Hunter used to call whatever the fucking pistol rounds or whatever in G2, but it was always, if you ever saw interviews, it was always implied people thought he could be an in-game leader or maybe he would become one day. And it's nearly always a player where you have some past history doing something extra, maybe not the primary caller, but you do something with it. And then crucially, it's nearly always that you're supposed to be like a smart player, because people just assume that has some sort of direct correlation with being an IGL. And I do think it does, but I think the part they always miss is this, mate. Like, I actually think if you're Hunter, it is the perfect time to do this. It's why I even get why suddenly all these conversations about Nico keep coming up, mate. Because Nico's having, like, the worst month and a half of his whole career at this moment. That's the best time ever to switch to IGL. When you know you're actually not going to be a top individual player, then there's nothing left to worry about. The real issue I have, mate, and the reason why it'll sound harsh, because obviously I don't really know what these people are thinking. I'm speculating. But I'm sorry, I did already guess. And I don't claim to be a genius. I already knew, spoiler, that Yekindar wouldn't be a great IGL, Twists wouldn't be. And the reason why actually is the last fact. It's nothing to do with, are they smart? Can they secondary call? Would they like to do the role? It's that, mate, if you still sort of feel like, yeah, but anytime I feel like it, I could just go back to being really good, that's going to be in the back of your fucking mind, mate. And I feel like you won't truly like commit 100%. Because I think when you do this role, you really do have to decide, like, right, basically what I'm saying is I'm not just becoming the IGL. Like, it's going to be the end of my career if I'm not a good IGL. Like, that's it. I'm transitioning forever. From this day forwards, all I do. By the way, I do think some of the classic examples in the past, that's why I think the old IGLs that swapped from non-IGL roles tended to be more like supportive elements, because they didn't even have some fantasy that they're still the star player. Like, it's funny that people still to this day probably don't even know that, like, almost all those Danish IGLs played with Glaive at some point in time. You were there with some of them when it was like people like MSL or Karen. And later, nearly all of them had some period where they were just a player, but the difference is they aren't tortured afterwards. But could I still be a top player? And what if I move to this team? Or even worse, I can tell you, I'll just say it right now. I know the rumors. I'll tell you, in Team Liquid, it's even worse than that, guys. Even though if you're Twists, this is totally fine. He is a very good player and he hasn't IGL'd for very long. The other players in the team, Pimp and you, or also if his IGLing doesn't go well now, he might just abandon ship as we're going down and join, like, actually a Vitality of Affairs as like another player. There again, he won't even be going as IGL. Well, the problem with that is you can't have that in the background of a project you're building. You have to, again, I know it's an old school concept, but like they're saying it, remember, in the Navy, is the captain goes down with his ship. The idea is if you're the captain, you're just committed to this. So one, I do like that Hunter made the change, because I do feel like, mate, this last year or so, in fact, CS2, let's just be real, he was hanging on for dear life, mate. He wasn't the player, wasn't it? People forget this, Pimp. In CSGO, not only was he like an MVP candidate at one of those prestige events, I think it was maybe kind of 8-0, I can't remember. It was that or Cologne, I forget which one. But I remember, as a result for that year, he was even like quite high up in like HLTV list. Like, that's like the one year of his career where he like peaked. His problem is, after that, he had maybe some of his worst years of his career once he got to tier one. So one, I love the timing of the change. But then two, look, it's really early days, so let's not over exaggerate, but I tell you what, out the gate it looked fucking great, mate. Like, I'm not even just talking about pure like T-side win rates, just think of some of the rounds, like on that Inferno, you have to remember that was the map that Vitality was like unbeatable on in season one, mate. No one could do shit to these guys, especially by the way when they swap to CT-side, they just farm you. You could never get a fucking bomb down. Some of the like push-pull on the Inferno game in this final was unbelievable, Pimp. Like, they were like actually completely like just toying with Vitality, like maneuvering them, like the calls here. You'd never believe this was like a new squad in G2. You'd think they were equally experienced or something. What did you think of the IGL side of it? What do you think of Hunter in the early doors, but what do you think of him as an IGL?
That's the thing, yeah. You stroke a nerve, and I'll get back to that. But speaking on Hunter specifically, I think that also goes into to speak about Saul. You know, in there's probably no better coach, you know, to make that transition with. I think it's the same thing we used to say about Brolin and Cyclone. You know, Cyclone is probably a great coach in order to include and form and I guess, you know, capture what it's like to be a new in-game leader for Brolin within Mouse, which we also did see went pretty well in the beginning. The first 6 months for Brolin were fantastic. Now we see Mouse, you know, struggling massively at the T-sides. They can't figure it out. I fear the same could potentially happen with Hunter. As you said, it is early day. I very much agree. I think the calling during Blast was fantastic. I think the combination between him and Saul was fantastic. We also got a lot of peaks into the timeouts. I don't know if you noticed during the final, but there was a lot of... yeah, there was a lot from Saw in particular, and I think the production, obviously, they get to it. We don't, so we don't have access to it 24/7, even though I would love to. But I think they sensed and they felt that there's definitely more impact coming from him, you know, which is part of the story, which is why we need to show that. One bit that I love was that he completely called out Sun Pierce, you know, four rounds into, was it Inferno, I think, or maybe Dust 2, you know, where he just said, like, Sun Pierce, what are you doing? Like, play normal, you know, stop overpeaking, stop doing. He basically called out a player within the timeout, and obviously he has that working relationship with Sun Pierce. I think that's sort of the energy I'm sensing that he's getting with Hunter as well, that they are joint in-game leaders within that team. Obviously, Saw does all the planning. He does all the hard work together with Hunter. They try to create a strategy. They try to create a way of getting the most out of the players. And as Hunter even said in an interview with us on the desk, like, sometimes he doesn't really have to do too much mid-round calling or too much thinking per se, because the way they set up the T-sides right now is simplified. You know, it's a lot of set executes, it's a lot of, you know, defaults into an execute, and it's a lot of deep playbook. I think Hunter told us that the playbook within G2 is the deepest it's ever been.
Oh, wow.
But nice. That also means that it's a lot of set plays, you know, and you only have a deep playbook if you have a lot of set plays or a lot of different variations of the default that you then keep practicing over and over and over again. So instead of him having to micromanage everyone in the middle of a default, well, he just say default into, I don't know, split A, and everyone knows exactly what to do at that point. So I think that's part of the reason. I would love to talk to Saw about it. I would love to talk to Hunter about it as well. But I think part of what Saw probably has thought is that we need to make the playbook as deep as possible, but also as simple as possible, so Hunter doesn't have to do too much mid-round calling. He doesn't have to be a Nico, basically. He has to have a deep understanding of the playbook, help build the playbook, and obviously be aware of what tools he has within the playbook. But then when it gets to the calling and being in those hectic moments, you don't necessarily need a guy like Nico that is micromanaging everyone, like Glaive did in the old days as well. You know, you were constantly being, whenever you're in a 3v3, he would micromanage you down to your every move, you know, press D, press W, go here, go there, you know, peek now, etc. I don't think you need that if you have good players around you and if you have a playbook that is practiced enough and deep enough, I guess, and simple enough to understand. So that's a notion of it. Early days, as you said, let's see what happens. Now everyone is looking at G2. Now everyone is going to anti-strat G2. There were even a couple of mats heading into the tournament that they hadn't played, you know, so they couldn't even be anti-strat.
Yes.
Which Overpass was a great example. Didn't go too well for G2, but now people can look at them, right? And that's always a different task as well, having to update your playbook or having to mask your defaults, et cetera, another thing I just wanted to point on, because it just struck a nerve, and let this be a message to everyone out there. You said it yourself, like, when you look at the twists of the world, the device of the world, Valde back in the day when he was even good in North, Electronic for that matter as well, when good players are your kinder, when good players become in-game leaders out of necessity because no one else can do it within the team and not because they want to, it's going to fail 9 out of 10 times. And I am sick and fucking tired of organizations not looking at the data that we have, that it's always going to fail. As you said, if you constantly have it in the back of your mind that I should probably still be a star player, if you twist, I should probably still be a star player, or I should probably be in Vitality right now, I should probably go back to face, how are you going to dedicate yourself 100% to be the leader and build that playbook and build a system within the team? It's the same thing over and over and over. And that's why I go crazy when I see players, you know, who is left as free agents, or coaches even for that matter, or talent for that matter, be like, yeah, looking for a team, I can play that role, that role, that role, and that role. No, you can't play 4 different roles, you fucking idiot. You choose one role, or maybe 2 roles, tops, and that's going to be your specialty, right? Because you're never going to be good enough if you're focused on 4 different things at the same time. And if you don't believe that you are good enough at just specializing at that role, that you want to open up the floor, that you can play 3 different roles, that's basically you just telling me that you're not good enough to be part of my project. And I know that sounds harsh, but I've even told, I think that was Devil Walk, I told at one point, he made a tweet that he was willing to coach, be a player, or work at the desk as a talent. Like, sure thing, that, you know, pick one. But what is it that you actually want to do? Because you're not going to be a great coach unless you're 100% dedicated to being a great coach. You're not going to be a great desk talent unless you're willing to travel 200 days a year and dedicated to become a great desk talent. And you're not going to be a great player unless you do the same thing. So I hate it. I hate it. And we have so many examples. You mentioned a few of them in Yekinda, in Twist, in Electronic. And I know we have Apex as well, but he wanted it, right? He wanted to be an in-game leader. Yes. It was his idea. I think Hunter, he has been asked to be an in-game leader for 2 years. He said no, he said no, he said no. Now he wants it, right? And that's why I think that his likelihood of finding success in the future as well is significantly higher than some of the wasted potential we saw with Device, we saw with Yekinda, we saw with Twist for that matter as well. Also, by the way, when a player turns into an in-game leader and they then go back to becoming a star player, there seems to be a bit of a drop-off. Yep. You know, I don't think we're ever going to see Twist at the same high level. I would love to, but it's unlikely. Same for Yekinda, same for Electronic, same for all of them. They lose that edge for some reason.
No, it does also seem like, I mean, the classic example for me is Shox. I mean, I even got to talk to Shox at the end of CSGO, and he even just said, yeah, the problem is I could never sort of not think like an IGL after that. Whereas the beauty of someone like Shox, if anyone knows back in the days, the guy was like the Cristiano Ronaldo. He had the ultimate diva mentality. He was never fucking thinking about everyone, mate. He was thinking about putting the ball in the top or winning the clutch, as it were. That was, so you almost don't want the guy to think that much. I know what you mean. By the way, the other analogy I often give, because I feel like it's the same exact scenario, is when someone who is the secondary AWP goes, I can be the AWPer for a while if you need. It's like, yeah, that better literally
destroyed,
be like...
Destroyed my career.
Listen,
destroyed my career.
But here's the problem, Pimp. That's why I even bring it up, because at the time, it was true. If you only have to do it for a month or two, you could do it. But the issue is, after a month or two, first of all, as they did with you, they might treat you like, well, you're just not a good enough AWPer. It's like, that's not even my fucking role, but okay. And then also, it's just like the IGL thing. Everyone might have a little honeymoon period where it's cool, but as soon as people figure you out, like the boring part is, Pimp, is if you do it the first tournament, yeah, they're not expecting it. When they watch your demo, though, and they're waiting for you on all the angles, and they treat you like you are, Kenny, it gets really fucking hard, right?
Yeah, I think we had that conversation on one of our reflection episodes, but it kind of destroyed my career. I was a great rifle. I was a very good secondary AWP, and I was asked to be the main AWP, and I said yes, and I was decent but not great, and then I got kicked, you know, and I never got back to my rifling level. You know, I think maybe I thought as an AWP, maybe I lost some confidence, who knows, but that was like, if there's one decision in my career that I would have wished I never said yes to, even though that I wanted it to happen myself, it was to become a primary AWP, because that just, I was a great secondary AWP, but I was not good enough to be the primary AWP. I was not good enough to, as you said, you know, I could go up against Kenny S one or two times in one or two games, and I beat him a couple of times as well, but the third time, fourth time, fifth time, sixth time, he would beat me consistently from that point onwards, right? Once he figured me out, or once I stagnated at my level. And I think it's a great analogy, because it's the same thing with the in-game leaders. It's also a thing of, let that be an advice to the players as well who do that. You know, if you transition to become an in-game leader and you then want to revert and go back, odds are you're never going to be as great as you were before. Another thing is that you put yourself in a very risky spot. You know, I said the same when Broland transitioned into becoming the in-game leader for Mouse. You are now the most expendable player in that team. If that doesn't work out the first couple of months, will be cut. You will not be invited back in the role you had before. You'll just be cut. Now Broland, is he working out right now in Mouse? There's you know, tendencies that we see now that the T-Sides are struggling. If you were to kick anyone from Mouse right now, if you were to replace anyone within the Mouse team right now, you're looking at Broland, right? He's the one that's expendable. So you also do jeopardize a bit of your career if you make that transition. So that's why I always say it. If you want to transition into becoming a primary AWP, if you want to transition your role, you want to be a desk talent, you want to be a coach, you want to be an in-game leader, make damn sure that's your plan for the next 3 years. Make damn sure that you're going to dedicate everything you can to that one specific thing in your life. Otherwise, you're just like you're just going to play at 50% in a lot of different fields, and that's not going to be good enough. So that's also, you know, no offense towards Broland, because I think he was a great player. I think Broland was a great role player in Mouse before transitioning into becoming an in-game leader. He was more safe in that role than he is as an in-game leader. So it's also with added risk and added pressure in that way.
Yes. No, I, the reason I'd also agree, I even think it does apply to Hunter, is because I think Broland right now is in the spot that Hooksy was, not at the end when he got kicked, but when he had the roster with JKS. Because the other problem you have, Pimp, is when you have a roster where people perceive the other four players are all good in their roles and only the IGL is the expendable one, the reason why you're the most likely person to be cocked is, cocked is also appropriate Freudian slip there, is because, bro, think about how many other IGLs would love to join that team and a fat squad of players. Like, I always used to think that about the Hooksy example. It's like, mate, if someone like Carrigan really did say yes, he pretty much would just do it overnight, because then he'd have that team plus he's Carrigan in the league, whereas you made your name off that roster. Right, I thought, and one thing, if we just run through the roster a bit, the interesting thing about G2 is there's interesting angles for everyone. So actually, a guy you briefly touched on there, probably the guy who's done the least so far in this team is Sumpius, the AWP, believe it or not. Actually, at the moment, it hasn't been that big a deal. Also, when he was in Heroic, he was a bit whatever. Like, it took, people have to remember, he was on the bench for a while at Falcons. It took him time to get going again. And I even thought early on in G2, he's actually been off his game, but he wasn't that great at the final. But I'll tell you what, this is also the Saw angle. This is his boy. This is the guy who's been with him all the time. So he's obviously choosing him for a good reason. That does remind me of those football managers where they have that player you don't think is that good, who's that, like, fucking central midfielder or something. But he knows their systems, and they think, I know this guy, I can make it work. One, this guy must be the Sumpius whisperer, because, like, I tell you what, they needed him in that Furious series, mate, and that one he was fucking cooking. Also, I do think a lot of people would look at this player and go, oh, is he even that good anymore? So I think if you're Saw, you will get a lot of credit if the months go by and he keeps getting better and he becomes actually like a good AWPer again. Because obviously it's a good gamble. There's not that many good AWPers, and he was a very good AWPer once upon a time, end of CSGO. I even thought, actually, he got hated on. You know, at the end of Falcons, before they made the Nico move, everyone always goes, oh, Magisk was the only one playing well. It's like, yeah, but that's because they kicked out fucking St. Pius for Simple, mate. St. Pius was actually all right. He wasn't a star player, but Falcons, if you remember, was a fucking dog shit team. They used to be irrelevant. Like,
yeah.
They used to go out in the beginning of the group stage. I thought he was all right. So I don't hate the gamble, but I tell you what, this player clearly is, as well as Hunter IGL. This is a gamble from Saw, though. Like, he hasn't gone for one of those Eastern European up-and-coming AWPers, or he hasn't tried to nick someone else's AWPers. He's got his own AWPer from the past few teams, and he believes he can run it back. So I'm interested to see that one, because actually, so far, that hasn't been some crazy honeymoon period in this team, mate. I've got to see where he goes with Saw. I'm interested to see this some pious angle.
Me too, and I was surprised during Blast London as well, because we got to speak to Hunter during the winners interview after the semi-final, and I asked him about some players. You know, I asked him about, like, who's the secondary voice? Who's the one helping you out now? You don't have Nico by your side, so who's your secondary voice? And he said Son Pius.
Oh.
He said he's putting in an awful lot of work in preparing, finding new setups, you know, especially on the CT sides. He's the secondary voice within the game from time to time, calling setup, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, I was kind of stunned at the disc, because the last thing I heard from players who had played with Son Pius a year ago when he was in Ents, when he was in Falcons, and even probably the beginning of G2 as well, was that he was a bit too passive. Like, he couldn't even call his own positions. You
right.
know? What you like from an AWP on the CT side is that you want the AWP to be like, I'm going to go A and get a peek here. I'm going to go B and get a peek here. I'm going to do this setup in middle. And then everyone around him can sort of figure out what they can do to support you. And apparently he was not that guy, at least not in Falcons, is what I heard, that he was a bit too passive and maybe a little bit too afraid of making the plays that would make him look good. So to hear that he's now the secondary voice in G2 and he's the one putting in a lot of work, you know, in creating CT setups and helping out Hunter being, I guess, the secondary caller, at least according to Hunter himself. I don't see why he would lie about that. That adds value to some players, because I do agree, like, from a pure output perspective, especially in a role as an AWP, it's not really been that great. He wasn't that great in Heroic. He was okay. He was okay in Falcons, but not that great. And same could be said here in G2. I think there's something to be said about his playoff performance, though. Like, he seems to be playing as good, if not in the playoff. And that's a nice little attribute to have, especially when you're playing next to Hunter, who had the same thing going for him in the vast majority of his G2 career. So maybe there's something to that. And then he also just seems to be a bit more versatile. Like, most of the impact he found during Blast was actually in pistol rounds and with the rifle as well, where he seems to be great, which also gives, you know, Hunter more tools in that toolbox. He doesn't necessarily have to be restricted by the fact that there's an AWP on his team. He can play rifle rounds on the T side where five people have a rifle, which may be great for the playstyle they're playing right now, given it's very much out of spawn, very explosive, you know. A minute left of the round, you go into and execute, etc., etc. It was very simplified what we saw during Blast, but that may even play into that. Reminds me a bit of Liquid, you know, when they had their stint where Nitro was the AWPer or Stewie was the AWPer.
Yes.
There was a lot of maps where they played five rifles on the T side, which was a meta for 64 days or whatever, but it gave them a lot of freedom and gave them an explosivity on the server that they couldn't utilize. And I see some of the same tendencies. So I think for some players, it's you know, if you want to stand the test of time, he needs to find a bit more impact with the AWP, but I have more confidence in that happening now, given that he is the secondary caller on the CT side at the very least. So he should be calling a game that is going to suit him for the future. And then question is if he has the individual level to actually pull off the shots and hit, I guess, the mechanical peak that he needs to, but that's only to be seen. He'll have the chance given the responsibility he has.
By the way, definitely interested in the idea that he's like a secondary caller almost on some like device shit. That's kind of cool. Also, I do think the interesting thing you pointed out there is people don't realize this. When back in the day we used to say about St. Pius, he's a big game player. That's like the euphemism we always use on the desk. I don't think people realize how rare that is, Pimp, because notice I'm not saying he's the best player. But what's weird is, it's funny, we all understand you're going to get players like the Stounds of the world where they're good players, but they just keep falling apart in the playoffs. Senzu was doing this until about 2 months ago. Bro, what's it crazy about people like St. Pius? As I agree, just no matter what level of form he's in, there's just something about playoff matches like have the opposite effect of this guy. My analogy would almost be, if you think about combat sports, there's actually a weird type of fighter in combat sports who sometimes it's actually when they're getting sort of fucked up that it like activates their like killer instinct mode, mate. It's like, you know, when they're pushed back or they've actually already been cracked, but that just makes them go crazy somehow. I agree, he does have like an extra quality to him that's a kind of compelling in that sense. I'm with you. Because the thing that I think is fun about breaking, that's why I wanted to do an episode where we actually break the team down. It's because, mate, another thing about G2 is why I like the analogy to Blade, is I'm getting crazy, like, Na'Vi vibes from this team because, one, they're really good on T-side. Two, I'm sorry, I know everyone now, because he won the MVP, is going to go crazy over it in Heavy God, who is a good player and I always did think was good. But, mate, I don't think there is a superstar on this team. I don't think they're even close. I think what's amazing is it reminds me of Na'Vi. You've just got the right pieces together, though, and the blend is what's so sick. Like, think about, again, if you want to do team building, Pimp, we'll go through them all individually, but if I just do the overview. So if you wanted to have someone like Heavy God in the team, if people don't know, you could already see him past OG, Cloud. You could already see this guy had skills, but he had a very set style of what he's strong at. Mate, to pair someone like with the Matisse, it's just genius. That's like, you've taken two different ends of the game and you've built, it's why having like a Rops with a Flames works so well in Vitality. They're just two opposite ends of the spectrum, but they can coexist. And if you get them to work on both parts, you're going to have such an expansive game. Like, I look at this one, mate. I that's the thing that I think is amazing. When we get to like predictions in the future, I have a hard time knowing if this team will win more tournaments, because actually the one thing that's useful about having the Zebus is you can normally just say, well, I imagine he'll be a top three player next tournament. I don't know that you can say that with these players. Like I said, maybe this is Heavy God's tournament. Maybe next one's the Matisse show. Maybe he does some prime first shit and just runs over every T-side. I think the coolest thing, I think, is kind of like the balance is really good. Like, basically, this is actually what Na'Vi wish they were now. Na'Vi wish they had five players like this, mate.
I actually like that comparison, because it kind of is what Na'Vi was, you know, last year when they got into that, you know, stint of 6-7 grand finals in a row and won a couple of them as well. Like, I think we had the conversation about that as well, you know, a year ago, where I looked at that lineup and I was like, every single player within Na'Vi you could replace, you know, apart from Bit, I'd say, you know.
Yes.
There's a player that is as good as that player, but together they just make the most out of, you know. It's the same analogy as when you say, like, you have a player that is a 7, but in a certain system or with a certain coach and a certain role within a certain team, he plays like an 8 or plays like a 9 for some reason. He won't be able to do that on any other team. He doesn't have skill to do that, but he does that in this specific team. And again, it's early day, but that could very well be the case with G2 as well in some of those roles. Matisse, you brought him up, right? Maybe a player that is, he's obviously a great talent. He has a sick raw aim, has a sick, you know, has a sick, almost carelessness of playing CS. He's just like exposing himself on the server constantly and just trusting his aim. But I think he does that knowing that there's a plan behind it. You know, he does that knowing that he's the second guy in behind Malps. He does that knowing that their opponents are probably not likely to instantly kill him because Malps has already created enough, you know, chaos around him or whatever that may be. And I think if you put Matisse into any other team playing the same way, he'd just be cooked, you know. He'd just be sold and probably perform like a 6 or 7 instead of a 9 like he did during Blast. And so I think there's some of that in it, of course, as well. I also do agree they don't have a superstar right now, but I will say Heavy God, with the way he's playing and his mentality and everything, I think he will become one. I think he should be the best player in the team, right? Should be the best player. And I think, like, there's so much of what Rops has done in Vitality I see in Heavy God as well. And I even will argue there's certain aspects of the game that Heavy God is better at than Rops. Also, counterpart is that Rops are better at certain things than Heavy God. They're two different types of the same player, in a sense, in the same role. But I could see Heavy God, you know, basically be the superstar like Rops is in Vitality. He's not a Saibu, he's not a Modest, he's not a Nico, he's never going to be, but he's just in that layer below, you know, where he can be the 5th, 6th, 7th best player in the world. I think he can transition into that.
By the way, he even said himself, if people didn't see, he actually said Heavy God, that he watches loads of Rops demos. Like, that's actually the guy he's trying to learn from. Yeah, makes sense that you can see it in his game.
Trying to copy him, trying to learn from him, but I like that, you know. He's not trying to be him, he's just trying to learn from him, you know, because you can see the clip play a very different style of anchoring, you know. Heavy God is way more aggressive, way more willing to take fights, way more willing to risk certain things as well, where Rops is, of course, a bit more passive, you know, and a bit more calculated, very smart about it. So is Heavy God to some degree. So I like when a player is finding inspiration in the best in the field, but he's not trying to become him. He's not trying to transition into becoming a Rops 2.0, you know. He just wants to be Heavy God, but then maybe take the best part of what Rops is doing and implement that into his own game. And that's kind of what a sense, because I also do hear players when they say, yeah, watch this guy, or I'm trying to become Device, I'm trying to become Fallen with it. Like, do you just, you know, you have certain skill sets that you probably have, or certain habits that you probably built, you know, the 4 or 5 years where you were making it a pro, all of a sudden making the decision that you want to be that player and copy everything he does is most likely going to take away the flair you have for the game. So I like that approach, you know, where you're finding inspiration, but you're not trying to become him.
Sure.
And that's what from Heavy God.
And also, mate, I'll put, if people forget this detail, The game so far in CS2 has been about being a really amazing, it's always aggressive rifler or AWPer. There's no, like, actually in this game, CS2, you don't win as the ROPS player. The joke is even ROPS doesn't. That's why ROPS went and joined Vitality. Like, that's why I actually do give mad props to Heavy God. Like, mate, he's going the hard route, because actually a lot of people even wonder if, like, those roles have died out in the game and it's just all about aggressive up-tempo rifling. And, you know, on CT, people just play their spots. People are sort of moving away from the idea of, like, dedicated lurkers. But I put it this way, if that ends up being true, he is the exception then, because he looks fucking great so far. And it's a player where I do think, no joke, almost every year I've seen him, he looks better. Like, I actually did see, yeah, this is one of the players we did actually talk about a lot back on the day on Snake and Banter. Even when he was in OG, he was the player in OG, a bit like Dexter before him, or if you go many, many years back, this shows that I'm old school unlike other people. Everyone else thinks Blame F started in Complexity. Blame F was in the old Danish Heroic guys, when he actually used to be like the IGL, but he's really just fragging people, right? These players, when you see them, you can already tell they've got something. Like, they're clearly better than all their teammates, you know. But the difference is, this guy's done it at every level. Then he went up to that Cloud9, which I get was a bit of a cursed squad. Mate, he was just good in it. Even when they were bad, he was still pretty good. It was the others that had their issues in that squad, you know. And then you come to this team, and like we said, he's set up to actually potentially be the best player in this team. So even though, look, I don't know, if you made me do a draft, like, pick these players or the world explodes, I'd probably still pick certain people who might not be as sexy a name right now over this guy. But the stats and the fact that G2 is in theory going to be a top team, mate, this guy has a chance to be like HLTV top 10 player, I imagine.
100%. I also think, like, in terms of, like, the team aspect of building G2, I think that's what Saul realized as well. Like, there's a lot of roles right now where Melps, when we dive into him, you know, I think there's certain positions where Melps is just not working out. Melps was actually better in heavy guards roles than he is in his new Nico roles. For some reason, I think if you're Saul, like, whenever you have any CT side positions that doesn't work out for a player, just put Heavy Guard in there. I think you can literally slot him into almost any given position in the game, apart from the AWP, and he will do fine. He will probably do better than the guy struggling, you know. And that's, again, it's a fine balance of taking him out of his comfort and pushing him in somewhere else to try to I guess cover holes or whatever. But I think that's how versatile he is. And another point I want to bring up just quickly with Heavy Guard is that I think in terms of the resources that he's required to get within the team to perform as well as he is, he's almost self-sufficient. And I think that's one of the greatest compliments you can give to a player. If you can pose a 118 or 120 rating on average, you know, or 115 rating on average throughout an entire season, but you're not really getting any help, you're not getting any setups, you're not getting any flashes, you're not getting anyone to bait for you, you're just self-sufficient and doing your own thing, that's more impressive than having a 125 rating where everything is about you, where everything is flashed for you, or where everyone is running in for you and you're the second layer, etc., etc. So I think there's something to be said still about, you know, when we look at stats, you know, that there's also a caveat to that, that look at the resources that player got to get those stats, you know. The resources as an AWP player is often great because you constantly have someone baiting for you, flashing for you, or the AWP is just a weapon that allows you to take a lot of safe fights, sort of, or just boost your rating a little bit. Whereas the way Heavy Guard is doing it is that he's doing it on his own. You know, he's playing often by himself. He's anchoring certain positions, and sure, he's implemented in the team and there is team play involved around him, but he's one of the players that is probably dragging out the least resources within G2, yet he's still having an output that is arguably the highest one in the team, and that is probably the greatest compliment you can give a player like him.
Yeah, by the way, on the Matisse one as well, I'll tell you the interesting angle on this one, which is one of the fun things about being like an insider in the scene is you do get those little tidbits from coaches and other people that, like, look, I'm actually in a position where I can sort of say them on my talk shows, but people, because I'll just throw them in there, like, oh, I heard, but I don't say from who. I feel like it often just, like, goes in one ear and comes out the other with fans, and they miss that. I actually tell them sometimes stuff like a year in advance, like, by the way, maybe Twists will be doing X, Y, and Z, and they're like, oh, what? And then they forget that happened. Well, when this Matisse guy, because I actually did around the time that basically, here's the story. If people don't know, a lot of the good players in Europe famously literally came from that team, Endpoint, right? If you remember a few years back. And the guy in Endpoint who was doing that scouting is the guy who's now in Fnatic. He's called Ross R. And he's a guy that they picked up, I think it was shortly after they got Mezzi, I think, into the team, because he's also somebody who brought through Mezzi and a bunch of other players. And basically, he's a guy where he's sort of actually in the category of an Ash, but his problem is he hasn't got a YouTube channel. he hasn't marketed himself. So just behind the scenes, everyone I know around this guy tells me that this guy has the eye, mate. When he, I mean, as far as I know, by the way, he doesn't even just claim it's just eye test. He's one of those people who has like some sort of like advanced stats equation thing you can use to tell, you know, how good people are at certain things. And basically this guy in general hasn't actually missed much on a lot of his signings. It's why even though, look, sadly, we never got to see the fucking Fnatic roster actually with Matisse in it play. But that roster, I always did think, looked better on paper than people gave it credit for. That was the one where he got Blame Effort. It was a steal of a signing, by the way. A lot of other people looked past him. But then he did get the Jambo guy that was one of the up-and-coming players. The Matisse guy they had really early on. Like, they had some of the pieces. They just never got it all together at once. So basically, I did hear that when he was in that team, it's a bit like the story you've probably heard about Wrinkle in NIP, which is, oh, now loads of people want Wrinkle, but they're too late. He already got signed by NIP, so NIP doesn't want to sell him, and you have to sign for Megabucks. And so now people have to go, right, well, we're looking for the next one like him, but it just isn't expensive. I heard it was like that with aggressive riflers for Matisse. I heard loads of people tell me when Fnatic signed this guy, it was only a month or two after that they were all like, oh shit, we should have got that guy. And so I've heard this guy could have maybe inquiries from other teams to get this person. And it's why, to me, it actually makes sense that that's why now he goes to G2. It sounds to me like you didn't just go to any other squad. Also, you know, you gave it a proper chance at Fnatic where they picked up and believed in you. But it's at the point where if G2 was going to buy it at that point, mate, you have to sell. If you're Fnatic, you're just not fucking Man United now. You have to sell players. You just, that's who you are. And you never got the roster to the land. So you understand also, you can't trap this guy forever and just never play a land. Then nobody gets anything out of that. But basically, I do feel like this was like a hidden talent people didn't appreciate. And it's like you say, Pimp, the reason why is, even though we all rave about how CS2 is this like aggressive T-side rifle game, mate, there's still not that many players are really good at it though. And I actually think what you're talking about is actually like a mad underrated quality. You know, back in the day, one of the players that was obviously one of the problem child of the Danish scene was good old Config. I always told people, all the shit with the drama that you hate about Config that's annoying is probably why he actually was a fucking amazing T-side rifler though. Because this guy had the ultimate, I'm turning my brain off now. I'm not going to think about the fact that when I go around this corner, there are two people crossfiring and they're going to flash me. I'm just going to go and I'm actually going to believe, I have to be delusional to believe this. I'm going to believe I'm just going to headshot both of them. Which, by the way, you have to be a bit crazy. If you, those sorts of players, Apex himself used to do this. You have to be a little bit delusional to do that, if you know what I mean. Like, it's not really, like, you think about it, if you are the mid-round player, the calculated lurker, you can be the one who like gets the edges, gets all the info, makes the right decision. Sometimes as the T-side guy, if you're playing the T-side role, you just have to send it, bro. You just have to go, you know what, I'm not a fucking pussy, please flash me in, I'm going in. And this guy, I tell you what, he's got that go button, mate. When he presses the go button, he goes.
He does. He does remind me a bit of Config in that regard, actually. Yeah. And you're right. Like, they're very hard to come by. Like, there's a lot of players who are incredible good at turning off their brains, but the output then also goes significantly down. You know, there's very few players who can do that. You know, and it's a fine balance. When we say turning off the brain, it's more so, as you described with Config, it's not necessarily turning off the brain, but more so believing that I am better than everyone else. You know, even though you, from an objective standpoint, know that you're not. You know, you still have to believe that. And I think having a player like that, even Config in his prime, you know, I think he was a bit underrated in the sense that having a player like that that's always willing to do that creates an awful lot of space for you. And I think Malps has the same, you know, Malps and Mattis have the same in that regard, but I just love the way they're being used right now, where G2 have chosen Malps to be the more aggressive of the two, dare I say, and maybe Malps is the more aggressive of the two, but then Mattis is kind of banking on that from Malps, because he's equally good to Malps at doing what he's doing. So it's a 1-2 punch, as we described during the game. That makes him fantastic. And again, I think that's Saw probably seeing that. You know,
by the way, don't you think that's even one of the things that's so beautiful about the design of G2? Because Malps was the player in this first season who looked like the odd one out, mate. He, remember, like you say, the story was supposed to be he's going to inherit Nico's roles, and he's sort of the successor to Nico. And when you give him those roles, everyone's going, well, if his numbers are great anyway, they're going to be. No, his numbers went down and he looked way worse. And in fact, it actually looked, Pimp, like in the whole like analogy of sink or swim, he was sinking, mate. That was going, and you can even tell it was getting to him, like confidence-wise. He knew he wasn't living up to what he was supposed to do. But the beauty, I agree, when you have him and Matisse, the pressure has just been taken off these two players now, mate. Because like you say, first of all, they've got more options too. They could even swap these guys around, or they could change up on maps, who does what. But you can tell having the two of them together, though, is making them so much more powerful. Because I think what Mab's really learned is this, Pimp. It's not that you aren't Nico. Look, you aren't Nico, but spoiler, almost no one else is. You also were playing with Nico, though. So what you're missing is you were getting the advantage of, like, the space he creates, the calls he makes. Exactly. Like, that's also helping your game when you do it too, mate, because a lot of the Malps clips were last year just running and shooting someone in the head with an AK, which is awesome, but, like, there's more to the game. So I agree. By the way, that's also the play I was very interested in when I saw this squad made, because I was like, mate, again, there's not an Nico and a Monacy here, so Malps is going to have to, they're going to have to figure out his role, or quite frankly, he'll be the one that gets moved on, because some of these other players are good. He hasn't been anywhere close to last year's Mobs, but he already looks totally competent, looks fine as it is. Like, feels like they have corrected that something. By the way, there's another thing I'll give Saul credit for. If he's the one who's figured out how to reintegrate Mobs, that there's a pretty sweet. I don't think Staz is a bad coach, but he couldn't do it. He hadn't figured it out last season.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's just another layer to the way Saw have built this lineup. And of course, it's very easy to glaze Saw, you know, without knowing if that was actually intended to be the case. If he sat down and he was like, I want that 1-2 punch, and then now he has that 1-2 punch, then all the credit in the world, it could be something that also just happened, you know, by accident in a sense. But I do love that combination of the two. It almost reminds me of Elise and Nitro back in the liquidation, their prime days, you know, having that 1-2 punch where Nitro was obviously the less skilled player in a sense, but willing to go in first, and then Elise would just bank off that over and over and over again. And I could see the same thing, you know, happen with Madison and Mouse, where Mouse would always be, you know, the maybe more raw aim guy, you know, that is willing to sacrifice a little bit and be relentless, aggressive. And then Matt is just banking off that, heavy guard banking off that, some players banking off that over and over and over again. Which, you know, to that degree, if Mouse is just, as you said, like, if he's just feasible, if he's just decent at that role, then that is just fine. And more than enough. I don't know. I've touched the subject as well, because I was getting so tired of people like wanting Melts in Nico's.
They were overrated, like, yeah, weren't they? I know.
Yeah, it was so fucking annoying, because Nico is like, he's so unique, you know, the way he called around himself, the way he mid-round called, et cetera, et cetera. You want to put Melts in there? Like a guy who just most recently was brought up to the tier one scene, tier two scene, and now you want him with all the responsibility of calling what's going to happen when he's playing Connector on Mirage? Sure as hell you don't want. Part of the reason why Melts was so good in the anchor roles was that he only has to take account for himself. He didn't have to worry about what X, Y, and Z move would do to a teammate next to him, because he just could do it by his own, and then his aim is absolutely fantastic. So I think Mobs would still be, you know, better off in a different role than he is in G2 right now. If all Mobs cared about was getting the best stats possible or getting the most recognizable cheering from the community possible, he would play in a different role than he is right now in G2. But I think also he realized that I can do this role to a good job, and I can be a sacrificial lamb to some degree for Mattis and for Heavyguard and for the rest of the team, and win a lot of trophies by doing so. And that's more value to Melts, obviously, than having better stats or going back into his roles where he's sometimes, you know, popping off and getting good stats. I just hate the community notion that they never picked up on that. Like, they never really saw that Nico was more than just, you know, 1.3 rating on average in his best time. He was the voice of everything that happened around him. He was mid-round calling. He was micromanaging everyone. And to some degree, that also helped Nico, because he would always, you know, you can't help to think that he would micromanage people in a way that would make his likelihood of getting more frags and being in a great position better, because he knew that if I set myself up, we win, you know, and Maltz is not going to do the same thing. So it was so far off the mark that they thought he could replace him in those roles. And
no, by the way, I think that's actually an appropriate moment to bring up, obviously, what the moment, something that's been an ongoing conversation you've been a part of, which is, this is the reason why, like, pretty swear, guys, you have to stop for a second and take, like, stock of the whole scene. You can't look at what one analyst or one figure says. What you have to stop and think is this, right? If only I think Fallen's overrated in some way, maybe that's just something I think. If someone else thinks one player's better than not, but if the entire fucking scene of every single analyst tells you, it was both of the IGLs in that team, they said it about Snacks and they said it about Hooksy, they were like, look, these at times were like decent or sometimes maybe even bordering on good IGLs, but they were never the greatest IGLs. They were never really a contender for, like, best IGL of the year, and crucially, they were pieces you could consider upgrading, and I think sometimes successfully were upgraded. What people miss is both these people had fucking Nico. It's funny, because the flashy angle would tell you they had Monacy. Mate, there's plenty of people who have had very good players. I think I agree with you though, it's the Nico angle, bro. What you're missing there is, like, even as like a secondary caller, this guy's bringing you like crazy impact. I don't think anyone else does from the stories I've heard, mate. And also, people miss this. Bro, the amount, ever since they had the old G2 with Nexa, Nico like took on way more of a role of things like throwing utility, mate. Like, that's not something normally a superstar like him would ever do. He would be the fucking shocks like you throw it for me, then I run in and kill the two. No, he actually started being the guy who like connected a lot of things together in his team. And I do think that was OP as fuck. And pretty sweet, it's why if people really stop and think about it, G2 could be awesome with Hooksy, with fucking no, with Stewie 2K and Nico Agile, and then also with Snacks. But it's why we're not actually hating on Snacks and Hooksy there. What we're saying essentially is Nico has like an OP quality as a player that almost no one else in the game has right now, mate. I can't think of anyone who fits that bill.
No. That's part of the reason as well. I will also say, and that's, you know, this whole Snacks thing in the Polish community, it's kind of fun at this point. But let's be completely honest, you know, when I really made that public, that I think that Snacks was not going to be it for G2, there's two main reasons. And I can't even, like, because I thought about it, you know, as you said, like, when someone is thinking X, Y, and Z about something, maybe it's just me who had that opinion and no one else agrees, but it's like, it's... How do I describe this? I was I'm not going to say the event, you know, but two events in a row... was I observing G2, standing next to them when they were playing, listening into their comms. We even had, you know, voice clips from Tess coming out during the game, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll tell you that during those two events in which one of them G2 won, Snacks was not the in-game leader. Like, if you would have observed from the outside, Snacks was, sure, he said something sometimes, and sure, he would, you know, call a default sometimes, but he was not in-game leading that team. There was only one guy in-game leading that team, and that was Nico. There was even a point, you know, and I remember this timeout so clear. You know, I'm standing next to them. We do it was doing a blast tournament. We do the show where we stand in front of the teams, and we're like, we don't have a desk. We're basically standing in front of the booth, and I'm observing G2 in round 22, around 23, getting ready to the desk segment. And there's a timeout being taken, I think, and it's Tess saying, please, guys, please listen to Snacks. Please let Snacks call the next round. Instantly, timeout is over. Guess who calls the next round? Not Snacks, you know. At that point, it's like, how am I even supposed to rate Snacks as an in-game leader if I don't even...
He's not doing the role, yeah, exactly.
He's not even doing the role, you know. Exactly. Yet all these fucking Polish guys are going crazy. It's his fault they won. And even though he had 40 games in a row with a negative KD, he did some great calling. Well, I bet you, in 90% of those great calls that you saw on the server, probably wasn't even him doing it. And that doesn't go away saying that I don't think Snacks did good at certain points in the game. And I think that he was, you know, was very sacrificial. He did offer everything in terms of making the most out of Monesi and Nico. And that's also part of the in-game leader's job, you know, sure. to know your place in that regard. But the best way I could describe it was that he probably lost the locker room. I think he lost the trust. And I think when Nico left the team as well, if you're Monesi, you're thinking to yourself, well, wait, the last 6 months, it wasn't really Snacks calling. Now our caller left, but we still have a caller that's not really a caller. Why the fuck would I stay here? Like, why would I believe that this project is going to work out when he didn't really take charge of the team in that regard? And again, it's based on a couple of tournaments standing on the outside. Maybe it's something Tess and Snacks worked on. Maybe got better after I saw those examples. But that's kind of when I was like, well, I don't even consider him to be the in-game leader. I think Nico is as much as an in-game leader as Snacks, if not even more so. So how do I even rate him as an in-game leader? So it's for the Polish community and for people from there, not even to take that into consideration, you know, when Nico was on the team, that's just being disingenuous. And that's just, you know, taking away from all the amazing stuff that Nico did within that team. Just to add another layer to that as well, spoke to Hunter during the disc at Blast London. And we obviously posed the question, you're no longer playing with Monesi. You're no longer playing with Nico, you know. You now have to play as a team to win. And the first thing he did, you know, without even being led in that direction, was that he said that no one can replace Nico. Like, what Nico did in G2 when he was still part of G2, no one can replace that. So he didn't even try to replace that. He didn't even try to find someone who could do that. Or he didn't even try to encourage Son Payers to be as big of a secondary voice, because he realized that no one, and he already said that no one can do what Nico did. No one can find that much impact the way Nico does, doing what he does. And that's pretty rich from a guy who just qualified to a final and then went on to beat Vitality the next day. You know, to still talk about that, about the guy who left you. So I think that speaks volume in that regard. And yeah, it's I don't give a fuck about Snacks or Tess in that regard. I think both of them could probably join a decent team and still be decent, but,
yes.
but they're not a top three in their role. And I think when you play with Nico and Monacy, they deserve to be surrounded by a top three game leader, a top three coach. And if you don't think so, then you're just wasting their time. And I don't give a fuck where you're born at that point. You know, it doesn't.
No, by the way, it was the same exact thing, like I say, with the aforementioned end of CSGO Huxley roster. My problem wasn't, this means Huxley is total trash. It's like, this is just, this club's too big for him, if you know what I mean. He should be at one level below, and then he could do a really good. By the way, I'll even say another deal, which is the Huxley one's the best example of all, in my opinion. I even think actually that roster was too good and it limited what Huxley could do, and he had to just sort of be, I'll just call a very simple loose game because I have all these amazing players. I don't think you even saw the best of Huxley there. You actually do want Huxley to have, like, you know, more control, and then he picks a player, then he designs a system and they all listen to his calls. So again, same thing, I agree with you. And by the way, I would say this to Monshaws, I'd tell them this in real life, both Snacks and Taz. I get along with both, by the way. I would just tell literally both of them, it's not a diss against you just go to a smaller team. And by the way, if you go to a smaller club and you prove it there, then you can eventually get back to this point. But the other problem is, and you both got this, you were both in the same position, you're both legendary players but not at the role you're doing in that team, which is part of why the fan for all's there, because they just want these people to be awesome. By the way, we all do, but if you're an analyst you have to face reality, unfortunately. And then secondary, you didn't actually earn those positions. Like, Taz didn't even coach anyone famous before this, mate. He just got that team because they gambled he'd just be awesome. Snacks, similar thing. Well, in Snacks' case, as far as I know, I think it was even said in interviews, it wasn't their first choice. I think they had a bunch of people around that time. And I'm gonna go ahead and speculate it wasn't even one or two. I would guess he was like the fifth choice or something. And you probably tried to get, you decide who, if you're a fan. Maybe they tried to get Shuhei or whoever it might be. You know, they didn't get them. And then they ended up, because the season was going to begin, right? Okay, we're moving on from Huxley, so let's just try Snacks. And if people don't know, that one especially was also, here's another detail, Pimp, to sort of close the topic of the Snacks one up for last year. This is why it doesn't really work, some of the shit talking as well. Because another reason I can't judge the good roster that he was on with Monacy and Nico and those Bass Championships as, like, this proves he was a good IGL, is I already know, notice I didn't say think, I already know at the time that Nico was definitely going to leave at the end of that season, mate. There was zero chance he was staying. In fact, the only question behind the scenes was, is Monacy going with him? And it turned out that was just an extra 6 months later, right? It was already 100% known, I've heard even within G2, that Nico's going. And so in that scenario, you have all those elements of, like, it's sort of a dead team, or it's not going to be the same team later, or again, by the way, here's another thing. If Nico's on his way out, you're not really going to tell him, right, just shut the fuck up and let this guy run the whole team. You're going to let him do what he wants on the way out. You know, just play your game, play well, you keep your stock up, etc.
Because that's the best chance you have of winning. You know, if you piss off Nico the last 6 months, then you're not going to win anything. But that is also, that's a nuance that also goes into the defense of Snacks and Tess. And I love that you brought it up. You know, it does feel like it's just two personalities that were too big of a team. You know, they were not ready for that level of Counter-Strike just yet. You know, they could have, as I said, Snacks could probably be a great in-game leader on a top 7, 8, 9 team in the world, but just not G2 with Monacy and Nico. And the same for Tess, maybe he could be a great coach on a smaller team, you know, in a smaller club or whatever. But it also does go to defend them. You know, what are they supposed to do when everyone around them leave when they get in? You know, that's also an incredible tough environment.
So I give them the benefit of the doubt in that sense. You know, like, I don't just write them off that they're trash, but I also do think they weren't doing all the stuff people hoped. By the way, also another thing, as you're saying, the crucial thing is the interviews, Pim. That they tell, sometimes it's what you don't say, guys, that says everything. Right? I will say it's very rare that players will actually flame like their in-game leader if he was bad. Usually because players know that what the player does is extra or he has to, they'll normally be quite kind. But I'll just say this. I always thought in that last year and then the first 6 months, if you ever look at the interviews of Nico and Monacy as they're, like, on their way out of G2 and then once they leave, here's the thing they do, Pimp. They just never mention the name Snacks. What they do is they say stuff like, oh, Nico was calling great, and, you know, I love to play with Hunter, he's a really smart guy, and, you know, we had some success, and then they just don't mention his name, which, by the way, in my opinion, is because, like us, they also think he's a legend, but they just didn't think he was doing an awesome job. They don't want to be fake and go, he was the one who was doing it all, but they also want to, like, it's a way of sort of, like, hinting at what's really going on. Like, what Monacy's saying in that interview there, basically, is, like, he was really just Nico and Hunter, probably, you know, or something akin to that, I feel like. It's like a polite way to do it.
That's also something to think about, you know, because if G2 then went in, you know, losing Monacy, losing Nico, and they felt that Snacks during that period had done a great job, they'd probably stick with him, right?
They should do that logic,
build up a new roster. Yeah, exactly. Now we want Snacks to build up a new team, and now we're giving him maybe a less vibrant team and a less, you know, less expectations, you know, there's going to be less voices. So now he can actually get to do his best job. So if they thought that he had that in him, that he could be that guy, you know, leading G2 as Hunter is doing right now, they probably would have went with Snacks, right? But there's a reason why they cut him. There's a reason why they didn't want to continue with him. And there's a reason why they desperately wanted Hunter to take up the role, which is probably why, because he never really showed in that time of period that he was the right man for the job. That doesn't mean Snacks can't be a great in-game leader in some other team, or like Hooksy. You know, I think he's doing a better job in Astralis now than he did in G2. And I think, yes, as you said, Hooksy, to get the most out of him, he needs to enforce his play style, and then the players needs to buy into his system, and not the other way around, where he's trying to accommodate for Nico and Monacy. Same could be for Snacks. You know, I think when he got into Gamer Legion the first time around, he probably had more of a say in how they play,
sure,
which, as an in-game leader, probably felt better for Snacks. So I even said it properly. I would love for Snacks to go back to a team like Gamer Legion. I would love if CTR doesn't work out at some point or whatever, or he gets sold off to some other team. Why don't Ash and Snacks join up again in Gamer Legion, and he can be at that level and prove once more that he can do it, and then maybe he gets the call up to a better team in the future. But if he's not willing to do that, and if the people don't think that's even deserving of Snacks, then in my opinion, you're just biased. You know, you don't look at... You don't look at the facts. You don't look at, as you said, the interviews, what people are saying, and especially what people are not saying, you know. And you'd be damn sure that if Niku or if Monacy or if Hunter or if anyone felt that Snacks was treated so unfairly by everyone, you know, by the community, by the analysts, by the critiques, they would have defended him now, you know. Now they have,
I think so, yes.
Now they have nothing, you know, in relation to him. They'd be like, yes, yeah, but I don't think Snacks did so poorly, yes, in our time with him or whatever. They would fill that in at some point, just like Hunter did with Niku, as an example. But none of them have done that. None of the players, yes, have vouched for him afterwards, because I don't think they could, because I don't think he was leading G2 for the vast majority of the time. So how are you going to defend something like that when they know internally that that wasn't really the case?
No, I also agree with that. I think the absence of them defending him in a weird way... Listen, it doesn't mean they agree with us. Like, maybe we're slightly too harsh on the outside. Obviously, they know things we don't know. But I agree. I feel like... By the way, Niku especially, remember, Niku the other day came and flamed fucking Austin when he said something about him on stream or whatever. Like, these aren't players that are shy about if they want to put a tweet or do a stream and just go, that's nonsense, you know, the guy does something. But they never did that suspiciously. And it's not like that means they think he sucks again, but it just means they didn't, put it this way, it didn't strike a nerve with them enough to make them feel like I have to say something. Whereas, like, I have seen, there's even players I do think are overrated that get defended like that. Like the aforementioned Fallen to the World, etc. Sometimes people will go to bat for them still, even if I don't think they're that good. But the way this ended up just being a mega G2 episode, but whatever, they deserve it. They surprised, yep, us. They fucking won a best of five against Vitality, included, by the way, all the way to the last map. I even think, by the way, that's the bomber. Because there's two things I want to say about Vitality quickly. One is, bro, this is how you know it in season one. Because in season one, when that train came as the decider, that was money in the bank, mate. I knew you were going to win every time then. You couldn't be beaten. It's definitely different now. And then secondly, they're all doing that thing, Pimp, which is right. If you're a normal team, you're supposed to look at map four, the Inferno, and go, fuck, we had them. We're at championship point. You know, we're even doing like a fucking phase C9. Like, we're rushing in the B site. They've got almost nothing left. If we just get the bomb down, but you didn't, right? Here's the problem, Pimp. Here's why you don't get to say that if you're Vitality. Because there was plenty of times like that in season one. You just always won whenever that would happen, yep, in season one, like the fucking Falcons Melbourne one where they had you 12-6 down on the fifth. You're supposed to lose that one. So you got, here's the thing, Apex, come on, bro, you got to just be fair. If the gods give, yeah, you, or if you steal five of those, you got to give one back eventually, mate. You can't win them all. You can't win every coin flip. Can't come up heads. It has to sometimes come up tails just for the sake of it. So I feel like, but the Vitality angle, like, here's what's cool, they're clearly not as bad as the haters think. The haters are making them, like, they fell off hard, like, mate, they're a lock for every semi-final, like, they're still pretty good, but they're also, I do see that they're not the season one Vitality right now. Yeah,
no, I agree, they're not, you know. And I think the cool notion about that is, I always think about, you know, how does one result change what we think about a team, yes, or how does one result change the story or how we evaluate a team afterwards. I don't think, you know, Inferno, great example, you know, championship point for Vitality, they win their game 3-1, G2 pushes them all the way in map 4 and Inferno, but they fall short. It wouldn't change the way we speak about G2 right now. Obviously, we're extra hyped because they won the tournament, but we would still be mega hyped. We'd still be like, whoa, okay, the title contenders. They were one round away from pushing it into a map 5, which then we thought they would have lost. They got to the final, et cetera, et cetera. It wouldn't change the course of conversation that we speak in regards to G2, but it does change it for Vitality. That one round changes a lot of what we speak about Vitality right now, because if they were to win that one, we'd be like, okay, they won the final 3-1. They got pushed by a great new team, but still in control, 3-1. Had it gone to train, you know, we all would have expected they would have won it just like they always did, and Vitality's back now. You know, that would
plus,
be the,
from what I
the
remember,
sort of like line of thought coming into
wasn't it even. I'm pretty sure it was the last map where he had the bad map. He was even fucking smurfing, by the way, mate. Before that, if that ends on map 4, he's MVP, he's back, no problems.
Exactly.
But yeah, everything's up, right? Everything's pointing up.
Exactly. So it's one round that it doesn't change the course of conversation for one team, regardless of what happens in that round, but it has massive ramifications for the other team, in this case, Vitality. Because I agree, like, Vitality are not as good as they were in season one, but them winning that round and them winning 3-1 against G2 wouldn't make me say on the desk that, yeah, I think they're back, or yeah, I think they play as good as they did in season one. Sure, the results are great. You know, as you said, unlock for semifinals, into a final again. If that's the worst you can do, just being consistently in the semifinals and the finals, by all means,
a lot
go
of people
ahead,
would like to be in that spot. Yeah,
I would love that, you know. But by all means, you know, it's they want to win trophies and they want to continue what they did in season one. And I just love that one round on Inferno where G2 had a weak, you know, force buy. Where, let's be honest, they shouldn't have won. Vitality stalled a little bit. No. I don't know what happened. I think Apex went out and commented on it, you know. But that one round changes the course of the conversation so much for Vitality, where it in my head at least, doesn't change a thing for G2. Sure, it just makes it more impressive, but it would still be the same positive notion that would surround them right now.
Yes. By the way, I'll give you the ultra copy if you're a Vitality fan, because obviously you're all desperate. Like, what have I got left to hang on to, Thor? They've lost all the streaks. They've lost the series streak, the event streak, even the final streak. Here's the one piece of copy if you're a Vitality fan. Now you know all these other teams are better than season one, though. Now if Vitality becomes number one, it'll be even more epic, won't it? Because they'll have to beat Spirit with Denier. They'll have to beat fucking all these squads that have made all the Falcons with Keisuke. Yeah. In some ways, like, the challenge is hard. It's something which, by the way, is what you always want for the great teams. You want challenges to keep them pushing. And here's the question I was going to ask, though. I think we'll wrap on this question. The obvious thing to ask, because it's a really hard question, actually, Pimp. It is, funny enough, this is why them being a bit like Na'Vi makes this a tricky question. The obvious question becomes, if you can win a LAN like this, where it wasn't just like a one-man mega carry job, it was like a pretty good all-round team effort, and you can beat Vitality in a BO5 final to win it, the question has to become, can and will you win more tournaments this season? What do you think? What would your expectations be for G2 after this result?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're going to be in more finals. You know, whether you win it or not, that's a good question. But I think they will be in more positions to win trophies. I think they're only going to get better. I think, you know, from what I sense in terms of the whole playbook and the way they approach Counter-Strike, I think that's only going to get better. They've only been together for 2 months. It's still new, you know, still new for Hunter in the in-game leader role. I still think there's more to get out of Melps. I think we haven't seen the best of Sun Payers. I still look at the team and I feel like there's certain things they could do better still, despite winning a tournament and beating Vitality in that best of five grand final. I also look at the landscape and hold them up against what else are they competing against right now. Mouse is under the downfall. You know, Spirit is making a roster change as well. That's a bit of a question mark. That could become the case where Spirit becomes unbeatable. Who knows? But not likely to happen. I think Vitality are not playing as good as they were. Falcon seems to struggle a little bit. You know, Na'Vi is nowhere to be found. FaZe is nowhere to be found. So I think in terms of the level of the competition right now, it's easier for me to say that, yes, I do think G2 will win. Not only because they're going to do great and become a better team over time, which I think they will, but also because there is no Vitality to beat them every single time in those grand finals. You know, there's no season one Vitality. Because I also will say that if Vitality were playing maybe just at 95% of the level they were in season one, so to speak, or if they were to go back to that level, you know, later on in this season, then I don't think G2 would beat them. You know, I think that would be too much for them to handle, because they have a lot of the same qualities, a lot of the same strengths, and then Saibu on top of that. You know, they don't have that megastar who could just... We saw it on Mirage, you know. I think that also goes to be missing a little bit. Did Vitality win Mirage 13-7, I think? That was a hyper-competitive game. It was 6-6 at halftime, you know. And then Saibu was just like, nope, I'm winning this game on my own, you know. I don't want any more of this bullshit. That was a map that they could have won G2. That was a map that could have gone their way had Saibu not turned up and dropped the... Was it a 4.01 rating on the T-side or something? It was ridiculous, you know, in that regard.
He went 16-0 on kills on T-side.
There we go. You know, had it not been for him, that would have been a hyper-competitive map as well. Yes. So I do think G2 will be in a final. I am inclined to say yes, they will probably win a trophy depending on how they schedule the tournament. You know, going to a PGL event, they seem to be very competitive at the moment, but not as competitive, obviously, as the majors, etc. So I think there's a world where they win more. And I am, I'll tell you this. You know, I have more faith in G2 with the current core will win more trophies than the old Na'Vi did. You know, and I know Na'Vi were in 6 or 7 grand finals and they won 3 trophies, I think, in total, the major and 2 more. And then they lost quite a lot of finals, which is also a bit of what goes missing in that story. They got to the finals. They didn't win them all. I wouldn't be surprised if G2 would, in the next year and a half, have 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 trophies in the bank. obviously depending on what happens with the roster and whatnot. But I see positions you can change. I see players where either you get more out of Melts or you find another guy who can do the job better. Either you get more out of Sunpeers or you find another guy with time that can do it better. You know, maybe Monesi at some point is like, why the fuck did I join Falcons? I just want to go back to G2 and imagine what would happen with Monesi in G2 with this current, you know, constellation of players around him. That'll be sick as hell. So I have faith in the G2 project, to be honest, yeah.
Here's the thing. I was going to draw a similar comparison. I do think also in that sense, they could be like a Na'Vi, where if people really do it as like a team effort like this, right? First of all, they do probably still have to like establish the map pool a bit more. But aside from that, I could see a world where they could be like a consistent top four team and they're just getting there again and again. Because again, it's like a well-done squad, like calling style. Also, by the way, a bit like Na'Vi, really good T-side. You're living off having a great T-side with a coach and an IGL who hopefully can keep updating between the events and stay on the cutting edge, which is so key. Like, people will forget that last year with Na'Vi. This is where, again, people have got to stop looking at stats. The amazing thing about Na'Vi last year was they actually did have like a bunch of like innovative T-side stuff they invented. Like, they had certain like Mirage. When they had that Mirage run, mate, you just watch their T-side. They're the ones that everyone else is copying. They've got like certain flashes they do at certain points to freeze the deep. And you can see in the next events, everyone updates their playbook. So I do need it. A lot of this has to be on Sword and Hunter. But I'm with you. I do think they win events though, mate. Like, I could see. Like, the obvious thing, like you say though, is I just don't think in this scenario, like if you meet the Vitalities or when Tanae joins Spirit, if you meet a Donk who were in super duper form, the problem is I do think that is always the counter, even though it's essentially the beauty of Counter-Strike and why we like superstars. It is supposed to be a team game where you win as a team, but there's certain players, there's only three or four of them, that are just so cracked out. If they really do, like you say, just choose to say like, sorry, I'm just going to actually have like a generational game right now, then like, by the way, I'm with you. If I'm G2, you don't whine, you just tip your hat. It's like, you know what can I do? That's what happens when you play Prime Kenny S or fucking Simple or Zewu now or Dong. Yeah, that can happen to anyone. But the difference is, the day that doesn't happen, a team like this, like Na'Vi, can be right there and take the trophy, mate. Because I know, I also think the same thing last year. If you have a look, a lot of the ones, is why Na'Vi had the bad BO5 record, a lot of the biggest events they didn't win. But I'll tell you what, mate, if they were in the normal event with a little BO3 and the other team didn't have an awesome game, they just scooped it up every time, it felt like. If you didn't go to their level, they took the championship, yeah. I think G2 can do that. This roster can do that.
I think so too, and I think that's one of the underrated aspects about, not underrated, that is one of the things that goes missing when you look at Na'Vi's results last year. You know, that was in a time where, let's be honest, no one else was playing super, super well.
No.
Mouse were just about to become a decent team.
Yes.
FaZe were inconsistent as fuck. Spirit were inconsistent as fuck. Vitality played with Spinks for half a year where he didn't want to play with them. They didn't want to play with him. You know, it was just a question of time before that was going to happen. So they kind of seized the opportunity in a time where no one else were performing at their highest. Falcons was a bit of a joke as well in that regard. And then they got into all those grand finals. But I bet you this, if Na'Vi peak, you know, Na'Vi peak 2024, best team of the year 2024 as they were crowned, they wouldn't stand a chance against Vitality season one. They wouldn't stand a chance against...
Wrecked.
They wouldn't, yeah, exactly. They'd get wrecked. They wouldn't stand a chance against the Spirit that is playing this season even, I'd say. You know, they weren't playing that... Obviously, they were playing well and they were the best team in the world, but they weren't setting a new standard as we see Donk does for Spirit, or as we saw Vitality do in season one here, or as we maybe get to see Falcons if they can figure out their shit too. And that's also, as you said, that's part of the notion. I think at the end of the day, it maybe doesn't even come down to G2 whether or not they're going to win more trophies. If Falcons all of a sudden gets their shit together with all that talent they have to work with, it's going to be tough. If Tenere comes into Spirit and he is as good as many people think he is, with Donks continuing to be as good as he is, maybe it's just not possible for G2 to win trophies because there's just another team that is better, have the more superstar material. And then Vitality, if they go back to season one, then for G2 to beat them, it's going to be tough. But, you know, there's going to be tournaments where teams are not showing up. There's going to be tournaments where they're not going to do well. And even in all this, we forget the Mongols who also won a pretty big tournament, who can also, you know, be a contender, which is, I guess I'll love to end on that one. You know, the Major coming up, it's just fucking open.
Oh, it's awesome,
season,
isn't it?
You know,
yeah.
It's great. I see six, maybe seven teams who all realistically could go into that Major thinking we can win this one.